pockets and his head down, and strolls into the village, trying to look like a man sent on an errand that he has every right to be about. He finds the place, just as she described it. There are three shuttered shops. No light in the windows above them. He thinks he sees a curtain twitch in one of the windows, and tells himself he imagined it. There's no one waiting for him here, and no one chasing him. When did he get so jumpy? And he knows when. It wasn't this last thing that made it happen. This fear has been building up in him. The terror put its roots down into his chest years ago, and every month and every hour has driven the tendrils a little deeper into the flesh. He can bear it somehow, in the moments when the imagined darkness matches the real. He hasn't felt this dread when he was actually in a cage, or in a tree, or witnessing the worst thing in the world unfold. The dread stalks him on quiet streets, or waking alone in a hotel room before dawn. It has been a long time since he's felt comfortable in a night walk. He checks his watch. He has 10 minutes to wait on this empty street corner. He has a package in his bag, all of his camera film, all the footage he shot on the road, and his notebooks. He had that envelope ready from the start, stuck with stamps. He had a few. He thought if things got dicey, he might post his film to Nina. He's not going to post anything to Nina. If he sees her again, he'll eat her heart in the marketplace. He has a marker pen. He has the envelope, packed neatly. And on the opposite corner of the street, there's a postbox. How likely is it that the postal service is still working here? He'd heard in the camp that it did still work in the larger villages, the towns and cities. Things have broken down on the border and in the mountains, but they're miles from the border and the mountains now. The box is open. There's a time listed for a pickup tomorrow. He waits. He thinks. Maybe there will be no car. Maybe there will be a car, and instead of a blonde woman with a hat, there'll be three women who bundle him into the back seat. Maybe he'll end there, thrown out onto the road between one town and the next, used and torn. Maybe there'll be a blonde woman with a hat who'll take the money she's being paid for this and say she's crossed the border. She'll let him out of the car to run in the direction she tells him is freedom, but there'll be no freedom there. Only the forest, and the chase, and the end of it in the soil, one way or another. It suddenly seems a remarkably stupid thing to have trusted his whole life to Roxanne Monk. There is a car coming. He sees it from a long way off, its headlights sweeping the dirt road. He has time to write a name on this package and an address. Not Nina. Obviously not. Not Temmie or his parents. He can't let this be his final message to them if he disappears into this dark night. He has an idea. It is a terrible idea. It is a safe idea. If he doesn't come through this, there is one name and mailing address he could write on this package which would make sure the images would be sent around the world. People should know, he says to himself, what has happened here. To witness is the first responsibility. He has time. He scribbles quickly, without thinking too hard. He runs for the postbox. He slots the package into the chute and closes the lid again. He is back in position when the car stops at the curb. There is a blonde woman behind the wheel, with a baseball cap pulled low over her eyes. There is a crest on it that says, Jet Life. She smiles. Her English is thickly accented. She says, Roxy Monk sent me. We'll be there before morning. She opens the back of the car. It's a sedan, roomy enough, though he'll have to keep his knees curled against his chest. 8 hours. She helps him climb into the trunk of the car. She is careful with him, gives him a rolled-up sweater to make a buffer between the back of his head and the metal housing. The trunk is clean, at least. As his nose meets the curled fibres of the interior carpet, he smells only the floral chemical scent of shampoo. She gives him a large bottle of water. When finished, can this in bottle. He smiles up at her. He wants her to like him, to feel that he is a person, not a cargo. He says, "Traveling coach, huh? These seats get smaller every year." But he can't tell if she's understood his joke. She pats his thigh as he settles in. "Trust me," she says, as she slams the trunk closed. From here, on the gravel path between nowhere and nothing, just around the corner of a screen of trees, Jocelyn can see a low-slung building, with windows only on the upper story. Just the corner of it. She hoists herself onto a rock and takes some pictures. It's inconclusive. She should probably get closer, although that's a stupid idea. "Be sensible, Joss. Report what you found and bring a unit back tomorrow." There's definitely something there that someone's gone to quite a lot of trouble to hide from the road. Although, what if it's nothing? What if this ends with everyone in the base laughing at her? She takes another few pictures. She's intent on it. She doesn't notice the man until he's almost standing next to her. "What the fuck do you want?" he says in English. She has her duty weapon by her side. She shifts position, allowing it to bang against her hip, and move forward.
"I'm sorry, sir," she says. "I've gotten turned around. I'm looking for the main highway."
She keeps her voice very level and calm, turns her American accent up a bit without really intending to. "Susie Cream Cheese, bumbling tourist." It's the wrong tack to take. She's in army fatigues. Pretending her innocence just makes her look more guilty. Darryl feels the skein pumping in his chest. It does it more when he's afraid, twitches and fizzes.
"What the fuck are you here for on my land?" he says. "Who sent you?"
Behind his back, he knows the women in the factory are observing the encounter with cold, dark eyes. There'll be no doubting him after this. There'll be no asking what he is. They'll know what he is when they see what he can do. He's not a man in women's clothing. He's one of them, as strong as them, as capable. She tries a smile.
"No one sent me, sir. I'm off duty, just doing a little sightseeing. I'll be on my way."
She sees his eyes flick to the maps in her hand. If he sees those, he'll know she was looking for this place and no other.
"All right," says Darryl. "All right, let me get you back on your way."
He doesn't want to help her. He's coming too close. She should call this in. Her hand twitches towards her radio. He reaches out three fingers of his right hand, and with a single swift jolt, he kills the radio dead. She blinks, sees him for a moment as himself. Monstrous. She tries to swing her rifle round, but he has it by the butt, catches her in the chin with it, leaving her staggering, hauls the strap over her head. He considers the rifle, then tosses it into the undergrowth. He comes for her, palms crackling. She could run. There's her dad's voice in her head saying, "Take care of yourself, sweetie." And there's her mom's voice in her head saying, "You're a hero. Act like it." This is one guy with a factory in the middle of nowhere. How hard can it be? And the girls from the base.
"You of all people should know how to deal with one dude with a skein. Don't you, Jocelyn? Isn't this your special subject, Jocelyn?"
She has something to prove, and he has something to prove. They are ready to begin. They square off to each other, circling, looking for a weakness. Darryl's done little tests before. He gave minor burns and hurts and damage to a couple of the surgeons who worked with him, just to see if it'd work. And he's practiced alone. But he's never used it before in a fight, not like this. It's exciting. He has a sense, he finds, of how much he's got left in the tank. It's loads. More than loads. He lunges for her, and misses, and lets an excited jolt earth through his feet. And he's still got loads. No wonder Bloomin' Roxy always looked so pleased with herself. She was carrying this round inside her. He'd have felt pleased with himself, too. He does. Jocelyn's skein is twitching. It's just because she's excited. It's working now better than it ever has, It's been so good since Mother Eve cured her, and now she knows why that happened. Why God made that miracle for her. It was for this, to save her from this bad man trying to kill her. She tightens her stomach and runs for him, fainting to the left, pretending to go for his knee, and at the last moment, as he's stooping to defend against her, she twists right, reaches up, grabs his ear, and gives him a jolt to the temple. It's smooth and easy, sweetly humming. He gets her on the thigh, and it hurts like fuck, like a rusty blade scraped along the bone. The big muscles just keep bunching and releasing, and the leg wants to collapse. She hauls herself upright with the right leg, dragging the left behind her. He's got a lot of power. She can feel it crackling on his skin. The kinds of jolts he gives are muscular and iron-hard, not like Ryan's, not like anyone she's fought with. She remembers her training for fighting an opponent who is simply stronger, simply has more to work with. She's going to have to let him play himself out on her, presenting to him the bits of the body where he can do least damage. He's got more juice in the tank than she does. But if she can trick him into spending some into the earth, if she can be faster and more nimble than him, she'll have this. She backs away, dragging the leg a little more than she needs to. She makes herself stumble a little. She clutches at the hip. She watches him watching her. She holds out a warding hand. She lets the leg collapse under her. She falls to the ground. He's on her like the wolf on the lamb. But she's faster than him now, rolling to the side so that he discharges his killing blow into the gravel. He roars and she kicks him hard in the side of the head with her good leg. She reaches up to grab the back of his knee. She has it planned like they taught her. Bring him to the ground. Go for the knees and ankles. She has enough. One solid blow here where the ligaments join and he'll tumble. She grabs at his trousers and makes contact, her palm firm against his calf to jolt him. And there's nothing. It's gone. Like a motor revved to a standstill, like a pool of water drained into the earth. It's not there. It must be there. Mother Eve gave it back to her. It must be there. She tries again, concentrates, thinks of the stream of running water like they taught her in her classes, thinks of how it flows naturally from place to place if she only allows it. She could find it again if she had just a moment. Darryl kicks her hard in the jaw with his heel. He'd also been waiting for the blow that didn't come, but he's not one to waste his chance. She's kneeling now on all fours, gasping, and he kicks her in the side once, twice, three times. He can smell bitter oranges suddenly, and a scent like burned hair. He pushes her head down with the heel of his hand, delivering a charge to the base of her skull. It becomes impossible to fight with a jolt there. He knows it was done to him once long ago in a park at night. The mind becomes confused. The body goes limp. There is nothing to be done. He holds the charge steady. The soldier sinks to the floor, her face in the gravel. He waits until she's stopped twitching. He's breathing heavily. He has enough juice left to do the same thing twice over. It feels good. She's gone. Darryl looks up, smiling, as if the trees should applaud his victory. In the distance, he hears the women pick up a song, a melody he's heard them sing before, but which none of them will explain to him. He sees the dark eyes of the women watching him from the factory. He knows something then. A simple fact that should have been obvious from the first, had he not been pushing the knowledge from him. The women are not glad to see what he has done, or that he could do it. The fucking bitches are just staring at him. Their mouths are as closed as the earth, their eyes as blank as the sea. They walk down the stairs inside the factory in orderly file, and march towards him as one. Darryl lets out a sound, a hunted cry, and he runs, and the women are after him. He is heading for the road. It's only a few miles away. On the road, he'll flag down a car. He'll get away from these crazy bitches. Even in this godforsaken country, someone will help him. He runs, pell-mell across an open plain between two great bodies of trees, feet pushing off from the ground as if he could become a bird now, a stream now, a tree now. He's in open country, and he knows they can see him and they are making no sound, and he lets himself think. Maybe they've turned back. Maybe they're gone. He looks behind him. There are 100 women, and the sound of their muttering is like the sea, and they are gaining on him, and his ankle turns and twists, and he falls. He knows them all by name. There's Irina, and clever Magda, Veronica, and blonde Yevgenia, and dark Yevgenia. There's cautious Nastya, and cheery Marinella, and young Justina. All of them are there. The women he's worked alongside these months and years, the women he's given employment to and treated fairly, in the circumstances. And there's a look on their faces that he cannot read.
Come on now, he calls to them. I got rid of that soldier for you. Come on, Yevgenia, did you see me? I took her down with one zap. Did you all see that?
He's pushing himself away with his one good foot, as if he could scoot on bum and hip for the shelter of the trees or the mountain. He knows they know what he's done. They are calling to each other. He cannot hear precisely what it is they're saying. It sounds like a collection of vowels. A cry from the throat. Eoi. Eoi. Eoi.
Ladies, he says as they run nearer and nearer yet. I don't know what you think you saw, but I just hit her on the back of the neck. Fair and square, I just hit her.
He knows he is speaking, but he cannot see any recognition in their faces.
I'm sorry,
says Daryl.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it.
They are humming the ancient song softly.
Please,
he says.
Please don't.
And they're on him. Their hands find bare flesh. They're grasping, pulling fingers on his stomach and his back, the sides of him, his thighs and armpits. He tries to jolt them, tries to grab at them with hands and teeth. They let him discharge himself into their bodies, and still they come. Magda and Marinella, Veronica and Irina, grabbing hold of his limbs and setting the power across the surface of his skin, scarring him and marking him and digging into his flesh, softening his joints and twisting them. Nastya places her fingertips at his throat and makes him speak. They're not his words. His mouth is moving and his voice is humming, but it is not him speaking. It's not. His lying throat says,
"Thank you."
Irina places her foot in his armpit and hauls on his right arm, shocking and burning it. The flesh at the joint crisps and turns. She has the ball out of the socket. Magda pulls with her, and they have the arm off. The others are at his legs and his neck and the other arm, and the place across his collarbone where his ambition sat. Like the wind stripping the leaves from a tree, so inexorable and so violent. They pull the skein, lithe and wriggling, from his living chest, just before they get his head off. And at last, he is quiet, their fingers dark with his blood. When she makes the call for Tunde, it has to be the start. Roxy Monk is coming back.
My brother, she says on the phone. My fucking brother betrayed me and tried to have me killed.
The voice on the phone is excited.
I knew he was lying, a little shit. I knew he was lying. The woman in the factory said he told them he was getting orders from you, and I fucking knew he was lying. I've been gathering my strength, says Roxy, and making my plans, and now I will take back from him what he took from me.
So she has to make it true. She gathers a small force. No one's answering the phone at the factory, so some fucking thing has happened. She figures he might have people with him. Even if he thinks she's dead. He'd have to be a fucking idiot to think no one would try to take the factory from him. She's expecting to have to mount an assault. But the gates of the factory are open. Her workers are all sitting on the lawns. They greet her with wild whoops, a sound that echoes across the lake, caught up and passed between the crowd of them. How did she ever think that she would not be welcomed back here, cripple as she is? How could she have imagined she couldn't allow herself to return? Her coming home is a festival. They say,
we knew you were coming back. We saw it. We knew that you were the one we were waiting for.
They crowd around her. They touch her hand. They ask where she's been and if she's found a new place for the factory. The war coming so close and the soldiers so intent on finding them.
The soldiers? United Nations soldiers, they say. We've yet to put them off the scent more than once now.
Yeah, says Roxy.
You did that without Daryl, did you?
A look passes between the women, hooded and mysterious. Irina puts her arm around Roxy's shoulder. Roxy thinks she can smell something on her. A smell like sweat, but more soupy. A rotten tang to it, like period blood. They've been tweaking the drug here. Roxy knows it and never stopped it. They've been taking off-label product. They go into the woods and do it on the weekends. It makes their sweat smell like mould. There's blue paint under their fingernails. Irina squeezes Roxy tightly. She thinks the woman's going to pick her up. Magda takes her hand. They walk with her towards the cold storage fridge where they keep the volatile chemicals. They open the door. Inside on the cold table is a collection of lumps of meat, raw and bloody. She cannot for a moment imagine why they are showing her this. And then she knows.
What have you done?
She says.
What the fuck have you done?
Roxy finds it there, in amongst the blood and mush. Her own self, her beating heart, the part of her that powered all the rest, a thin and rotting piece of gristle, the muscle striated purple and red. There was a day, 3 days after Daryl took it from her, that she realized she wasn't going to die. The spasms across her chest had ceased. The red and yellow flashes had disappeared from her eyes. She had bandaged herself up and walked to a hut she knew in the woods and waited there for death. But on the third day, she knew death was not going to take her. She thought then, it's because my heart is still alive. Outside my body, in his body, but still alive. She thought, I would know if it were dead. But she hadn't known. She holds her palm to her collarbone. She waits to feel something. Mother Eve comes to meet Roxanne Monk off the Midnight Army transport into the train station in Bazarabiaska, a city a little to the south. She could have waited for Roxy in the palace, but she wanted to see her face. Roxy Monk is thinner. She looks pained and worn. Mother Eve holds her in a tight embrace, forgetting for a moment to probe or question with her special sense. There's the smell of her friend, just the same, pine needles and sweet almonds. There's the feeling of her. Roxy pulls away awkwardly. Something's wrong. She's almost silent as they drive through the empty streets to the palace.
You're the president now, then?
Ali smiles.
It couldn't wait.
She pats the back of Roxy's hand, and Roxy moves the hand away.
Now you're back? We should talk about the future.
Roxy smiles a tight, thin-lipped smile. In Mother Eve's apartments in the palace, when the last door is closed and the last person is gone, Ali looks at her friend wonderingly.
I thought you were dead, she says.
I almost was, says Roxy.
But you came back to life. The one the voice told me was coming. You are a sign, says Ali. You are my sign, just as you always were. God's favor is with me.
Roxy says,
don't know about that.
She undoes the top three buttons of her T-shirt to show what's there to be seen, and Ali sees it. And she understands that this sign which she hoped would point in one direction is pointing entirely in another. There was a symbol that God placed in the sky after the last time she destroyed the world. She licked her thumb and drew an arc across the heavens spreading the multitude of color and sealing her promise that she would never again flood the face of the earth. Allie looks at the crooked upside-down bow of the curved scar across Roxy's chest. She draws her fingertips along it gently, and though Roxy looks away, she lets her friend touch her wound. The rainbow, inverted.
"You were the strongest one I ever knew," she says, "and even you have been brought low."
Roxy says, "I wanted you to know the truth."
"You were right," says Allie. "I know what this means."
Never again. The promise written across the clouds. This thing cannot be allowed to happen again.
"Listen," says Roxy. "We should talk about the North. The war.
You're a powerful woman now."
She makes a little half-smile. "You always was on your way somewhere. But there's bad things happening up there.
I've been thinking. Maybe you and me together can find a way to stop it."
"There's only one way to stop it," says Mother Eve, calmly.
"I just think, I don't know, we could work it out somehow. I could go on telly, talk about what I've seen, what's happened to me."
"Oh, yes. Show them the scar.
Tell what your brother did to you."
There would be no stopping the fury then.
The war would begin in earnest.
"No, that's not what I mean. No, Eve. You don't understand. It's going to absolute shit up there. I mean, crazy fucking batshit weirdo religious nutcases going around killing kids."
Eve says,
"There's only one way to put it right. The war has to stop now. The real war. The war of all against all.
Gog and Magog," whispers the voice.
"That's right."
Roxy sits back a little bit in her chair. She's told Mother Eve the whole story. Every last part of what she saw and what was done to her and what she was made to do.
"We have to stop the war," she says. "I still know how to get stuff done, you know. I've been thinking. Put me in charge of the army in the North. I'll keep order, we'll patrol the border, real borders, like a real country. And you know, we'll talk to your friends in America. They don't want fucking Armageddon breaking out here. God knows what weapons a Wadi Atif has."
Mother Eve says, "You want to make peace."
"Yeah?"
"You want to make peace? You want to take charge of the army in the North?"
"Well, yeah."
Mother Eve's head starts to shake as if someone else is shaking it for her. She gestures to Roxy's chest.
"Why would anyone take you seriously now?"
Roxy jerks her whole body away. She blinks. She says,
"You want to start Armageddon."
Mother Eve says, "It's the only way. It's the only way to win." Roxy says,
"Do you know what's going to happen? We'll bomb them and they'll bomb us and it'll spread out wider and wider and America will get involved and Russia and the Middle East and the women will suffer as much as the men, Evie. The women will die just as much as the men will if we bomb ourselves back to the Stone Age."
"And then we will be in the Stone Age."
Yeah.
"And then there will be 5,000 years of rebuilding. 5,000 years where the only thing that matters is, can you hurt more? Can you do more damage? Can you instill fear?"
"Yeah."
"And then the women will win." A silence spreads through the room and into Roxy's bones, up through the marrow, a cold, liquid stillness.
"Bloody hell,"
says Roxy. "So many people have told me you're crazy, you know, and I never believed any of them." Mother Eve watches her with great serenity. "I was always like,
No. If you met her, you'd know she's clever. And she's been through a lot, but she's not crazy.
She sighs, looks at her hands, palms and backs.
I went looking for information about you ages ago. I mean, I had to know.
Mother Eve watches her, as if from very far away.
It's not that hard to find out who you used to be. It's all over some bits of the internet. Alison Montgomery Taylor.
Roxy takes her time with the words.
I know, says Mother Eve. I know it was you who made it all disappear, and I'm grateful. If that's what you're asking, I'm still grateful.
But Roxy frowns, and in that frown, Allie knows she's made a mistake somewhere along the line. Some little minor misalignment in her understanding.
Roxy says, I'll get it, right? If you killed him, he probably deserved killing. But you should go and look at what his wife's doing now. She's called Williams now. Remarried a Lyle Williams in Jacksonville. She's still there.
You should go and look her up.
Roxy stands up. Don't do this, she says. Please don't. Mother Eve says, I'll always love you.
Roxy says,
yeah, I know.
Mother Eve says,
it's the only way. If I don't do it, they will.
Roxy says,
if you really want the women to win, go and look up Lyle Williams in Jacksonville and his wife.
Allie lights a cigarette in the quiet of a stone room in the convent overlooking the lake. She brings it to flame in the old way, with a spark from her fingertips. The paper crackles and blackens into glowing light. She breathes it in to the edges of her lungs. She is full of her old self. She has not smoked for years. Her head swims. It is not hard to find Mrs. Montgomery Taylor. 1, 2, 3 words typed into a search box, and there she is. She runs a children's home now, under the auspices and with the blessing of the new church. She was an early member there in Jacksonville. In a photograph on the website of their children's home, her husband stands behind her. He looks a great deal like Mr. Montgomery Taylor. A shade taller, perhaps. A little bushier in the moustache, a little rounder in the cheek. Different colouring. A different mouth, but the same broad category of man. A weak man. The kind of man who, before any of this, would still have done what he was told. Or perhaps she's remembering Mr. Montgomery Taylor. They look sufficiently similar that Allie finds herself rubbing her jaw in the place where Mr. Montgomery Taylor hit her, as if the blow had landed only moments ago. Lyle Williams and his wife, Eve Williams. And together they care for children. It is Allie's own church that has made this thing possible. Mrs. Montgomery Taylor did always know how to work a system to best advantage. The website for the children's home she operates talks about the love and discipline and tender respect they teach. She could have looked any time. She cannot think why she has not turned on this old light before. The voice is saying things. It's saying, don't do it. It's saying, turn away. It's saying, step away from the tree, Eve, with your hands up. Allie doesn't listen. Allie picks up the handset of the telephone on the desk here in the convent room overlooking the lake. She dials a number. Far away in a hallway with a side table topped by a crocheted runner, a telephone rings.
Hello?
Says Mrs. Montgomery Taylor.
Hello?
Says Allie.
Oh, Allison,
says Mrs. Montgomery Taylor.
I hoped you'd call.
Like the first drops of rain. Like the earth saying, I'm ready for it. Come and get me. Allie says,
What have you done?
Mrs. Montgomery Taylor says,
Just what the Spirit has commanded me to do.
Because she knows what Allie means. Somewhere inside her heart, for all the twisting and turning, she does know, as she's always known. Allie can see in that moment that everything will disappear is a fantasy, has always been a delightful dream. Not the past, not the lines of pain inscribed on the human body, not a thing will ever disappear. While Allie has been making her life, Mrs. Montgomery Taylor has also continued, growing monstrous as the clock turned. Mrs. Montgomery Taylor keeps up a bright line of chatter. She's so honored to receive a telephone call from Mother Eve, although she always knew she would. She understood what was meant by the name Allie had taken on, that she was Allie's real mother, her spiritual mother, and hasn't Mother Eve always said that the mother is greater than the child? She understood what was meant by that, too, that the mother is the one who knows best. She is so happy, so delighted, that Allie understood that everything she and Clyde did, they did for her own good. Allie feels sick.
You were just a young girl, so wild, says Mrs. Montgomery Taylor. You drove us to distraction. I saw that the devil was in you.
Allie remembers it now. She has not brought it out into the light these many years. She pulls it from the back of her mind. She blows the dust from this heap of rags and bones. She stirs them with a fingertip. She arrived at the home of the Montgomery Taylors, a jangled child, beady and bird-like and wild, her eyes seeing everything, her hands in everything. It was Mrs. Montgomery Taylor who brought her. And Mrs. Montgomery Taylor who wanted her, and Mrs. Montgomery Taylor who spanked her when her hand was in the raisin jar. It was Mrs. Montgomery Taylor who grabbed her arm and threw her to her knees and commanded her to pray that the Lord would forgive her sin, over and over on her knees.
We had to drive that devil out of you. You see that now, don't you?
Says Mrs. Montgomery Taylor, now Mrs. Williams. And Allie does see it. It is as clear to her now as if she were watching it through the glass panes of their own sitting room. Mrs. Montgomery Taylor tried to pray the devil out of her, and then to beat the devil out of her. And then she had a new idea.
Everything we did, she says, we did for love of you. You needed to be taught discipline.
She remembers the nights Mrs. Montgomery Taylor would put the polka on the radio real loud, and then Mr. Montgomery Taylor would ascend the stairs to give her the teachings. She remembers all at once and with great clarity which order those steps occurred in. First, the polka music, then the ascent of the stairs. Beneath every story, there is another story. There is a hand within the hand. Hasn't Allie learned that well enough? There is a blow behind the blow. Mrs. Montgomery Taylor's voice is sly and confidential.
I was the first member of your new church in Jacksonville, Mother. When I saw you on the television, I knew that God had sent you to me as a sign. I knew that she was working through me when we took you in, and that she knew all that I had done for her glory. I was the one who made the police documents disappear. I've been caring for you all these years, darling.
Allie thinks of all that was done in the house of Mrs. Montgomery Taylor. She cannot pull apart the strands of it. Has never separated the experiences into individual moments to examine each one closely and particularly. Remembering it, is like a sudden flash of light upon carnage. Body parts and machinery in chaos and a sound that builds from a reedy cry to a full-throated scream and then cuts off to a low, humming, almost silence.
"You understand," she says, "that God was working in us. All that we did, Clyde and I, we did so that you would be here."
It was her touch she felt every time Mr. Montgomery Taylor laid himself upon her. "She cuppeth the power in her hand. She commandeth it to strike." Allie says,
"You told him to hurt me."
And Mrs. Montgomery Taylor, now Mrs. Williams, says,
"We didn't know what else to do with you, Angel. He just wouldn't listen to anything we said."
"And do you do the same now with other children, with the children in your care?" But Mrs. Montgomery Taylor, now Williams, has always been shrewd, even in her madness.
"All children need different kinds of love," she says. "We do what's needed to care for them."
Children are born so small. It does not matter if they are boys or girls. They are all born so weak and so powerless. Allie comes to pieces quite gently. All the violence in her has been spent out 100 times. When this thing happens, she is calm, floating above the storm, watching the raging sea below. She puts the fragments together, sorting and resorting them. How much would it take to put it right? Investigations and press conferences and admissions. If it is Mrs. Montgomery Taylor, it is others too. More than she can count, probably. Her own reputation will suffer. Everything will come out, her past and her story and the lies and half-truths. She could move Mrs. Montgomery Taylor quietly on elsewhere. She might even find a way to have her killed. But to denounce her would be to denounce everything. If she roots this out, she roots out herself. Her own roots are rotten already. And with this, she is undone. Her mind disconnects from itself. For a while she's not here. The voice tries to speak, but the howling of the wind inside her skull is too loud, and the other voices now too numerous. In her mind for a time, it is the war of all against all. It cannot sustain. After a while she says to the voice,
"Is this what it's like to be you?"
And the voice says,
"Fuck you. I told you not to do it. You should never have been friends with that monk. I told you and you wouldn't listen. She was just a soldier. What did you need a friend for? You had me. You always had me."
Allie says,
"I never had anything."
The voice says,
"Well, what now then, if you're so clever?"
Allie says,
"I keep meaning to ask, who are you? I've wondered for a while. Are you the serpent?"
The voice says,
"Oh, you think because I swear and tell you to do stuff, I must be the devil? It's crossed my mind. And here we are. How am I supposed to tell which side is good and which is bad?"
The voice takes a deep breath. Allie's never heard it do that before.
"Look," says the voice, "we've reached a tricky moment here. I'll give you that. There were things you were never supposed to look at, and now you've gone and looked at them. The whole point of me was to keep things simple for you. You see? That's what you wanted. Simple. Feel safe. Certainty. Feel safe. I don't know if you're aware," says the voice, but you're lying on the floor of your office right now, with the phone cradled under your right ear, listening to the sound of beep, 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 and you won't stop shaking. At some point, someone's gonna come in and find you like this. You're a powerful woman. If you're not back soon, bad things are gonna happen. So I'm giving you the crib sheet right now. Maybe you'll understand it. And maybe you won't. Your whole question is the mistake. Who's the serpent? And who's the holy mother? Who's bad and who's good? Who persuaded the other to eat the apple? Who has the power and who's powerless? All of these questions are the wrong question. It's more complicated than that, sugar. However complicated you think it is, everything is always more complicated than that. There are no shortcuts. Not to understanding and not to knowledge. You can't put anyone into a box. Listen, even a stone isn't the same as any other stone. So I don't know where y'all think you get off labeling humans with simple words and thinking you know everything you need. But most people can't live that way, even some of the time. They say only exceptional people can cross the borders. Truth is, anyone can cross. Everyone has it in them. But only exceptional people can bear to look it in the eye. Look, I'm not even real. I'm not real like you think real means. I'm here to tell you what you want to hear. But the things you people want, I'm telling you. Long time ago, says the voice, another prophet came to tell me that some people I'd made friends with wanted a king. I told them what a king would do. He'd take their sons for soldiers and their daughters for cooks. I mean, if the daughters were lucky, right? He'd tax their grain and their wine and their cows. These weren't people with iPads, you feel me? Grain and wine and cows were what they had. I said, look, a king will basically make you into slaves, and don't come crying to me when that happens. That's what kings do. What can I tell you? Welcome to the human race. You people like to pretend things are simple, even at your own cost. They still wanted a king. Ali says, are you trying to tell me there's literally no right choice here? The voice says, there's never been a right choice, honey bun. The whole idea that there are two things and you have to choose is the problem. Ali says, and what shall I do? The voice says, listen, I'll level with you. My optimism about the human race is not what it once was. I'm sorry it can't be simple for you anymore. Ali says, it's getting dark. The voice says, sure is. Ali says, welp. I see what you're saying. Been nice working with you. The voice says, likewise. See you on the other side. Mother Eve opens her eyes. The voices in her head are gone. She knows what to do.
Audio guide for the Museum of Post-Cataclysm Artifacts. This case contains part of a wooden figure. It is the torso of the sun in agony, a minor cultic figure. Like the carved female wooden figures in the nearby display case, this carving is approximately 500 years old.
On the desk of Margot's assistant, a phone rings.
She's in a meeting, the assistant tells a voice on the other end of the line, that Senator Cleary can't be reached right now, but she can take a message.
Senator Cleary is in a meeting with North Star Industries and the Department of Defense. They want her advice. She's an important person now. She has the ear of the president. Senator Cleary cannot be disturbed. The voice on the other end of the line speaks a few more words. They sit Margot on the cream-colored couch in her own office when they tell her. They say, Senator Cleary, we have bad news. We've had word from the UN. She's been found in the woods. She's still alive, just barely. Her injuries are extensive. We don't know if she'll pull through. We think we know what happened. The man is dead already.
We're so sorry, Senator. We're so sorry.
And Margot is falling. Her own daughter, who put the tips of her fingers in the center of Margot's palm once and gave her the lightning, who curled her little waving hand around Margot's thumb once and held on so tightly that Margot knew for the first time that she was the strong one. Now and forever she would put her body between this little scrap and harm. That was her job. There was a time when Jocelyn was 3. They were exploring the apple orchard at her parents' farm together. Mom and little daughter, with the slow intensity with which a 3-year-old examines each leaf and stone and splinter. It was late autumn. The windfalls just turning to rot. Joss stooped down, turned over one of the browning fruit, and a cloud of wasps flew from it. Margot had always had a particular terror of wasps, ever since a child. She grabbed Joss and wrapped her arms around her, holding her close to her body. Grabbed her and ran for the house. Joss was fine, not a scratch on her. And Margot, when they were comfortably seated on the couch again, found that she had been stung 7 times. All the way down her good right arm. She had not even felt it. That was her job. She finds she's telling them this story. In a gabble, in a moan, she cannot stop telling this story, as if by telling it she could go back now just a little way along the path and put her body between Joss and the harm that found her. Margot says,
How can we stop this happening?
They tell the senator it has already happened. Margot says,
No. How can we stop it happening again?
There is a voice in Margot's head. It says, You can't get there from here. She sees it all in that instant. The shape of the tree of power. Root to tip, branching and rebranching. Of course, the old tree still stands. There is only one way, and that is to blast it entirely to pieces. In a mailbox in rural Idaho, a package sits unclaimed for 36 hours. It is a yellow, padded envelope, about the size of 3 paperback books, though it rattles a little when shaken. The man who was sent to the post office for it feels it suspiciously. It has no return address. Doubly suspicious. But there's no solid bulk that might indicate a homemade bomb. He slits it open along the side with a pocket knife, just to be certain. Into the palm of his hand tumble 8 undeveloped rolls of photographic film, one by one. He peers in further. There are notebooks and USB sticks. He blinks. He's not a smart man, though he is a cunning one. He hesitates for a moment, thinking this package might be just another piece of junk, sent to the group by men who are more crazy than disaffected. They've wasted time before on meaningless trash that men claimed represented the start of the new order. He's been personally berated by urban docs for bringing back parcels that might contain tracking devices within homemade muffins or inexplicable gifts of jockey shorts and lube. He pulls a handful of the notes out at random and reads the even hand. For the first time today on the road, I was afraid. He sits in his pickup truck, considering it. There have been others he's thrown away without hesitation. Others he knows he must bring back. In the end, the thought slowly crosses his mind that the camera films, or the USB sticks, might contain nudie pictures. Might as well see what they are anyway. The man in the pickup tips the rolls of film back into the envelope and pokes the notes in after them. Might as well. Mother Eve says,
When a multitude speaks with one voice, that is strength, and that is power.
The crowd roars its assent.
We speak with one voice now, she says. We are one mind, and we call upon America to join us in the struggle against the North.
Mother Eve holds up her hands for silence, showing the eyes in the center of her palms.
Well, the greatest nation on the earth, the land where I was born and raised, look on while innocent women are slaughtered and while freedom is destroyed? Will they watch in silence while we burn? If they abandon us, who will they not abandon? I call on women across the world to bear witness to what happens here. Bear witness and learn what you can expect to happen to you. If there are women in your government, hold them to account. Call on them to act.
Convent walls are thick, and convent women are clever. And when Mother Eve warns them that the apocalypse is near at hand, and only the righteous will be saved, she can call the world to a new order. The end of all flesh is near, because the earth is filled with violence. Therefore, build an ark. It will be simple. That is all they want. There are days that follow one after the next, while Jocelyn heals, and while it becomes clear that she will never fully heal, and while something hardens in Margot's heart. She appears on the television to talk about Joss's injuries. She says,
Terrorism can strike anywhere. At home or abroad. She says, The most important thing is that our enemies, both global and domestic, must know that we are strong and that we will retaliate.
She looks down the camera lens and says,
Whoever you are, we will retaliate.
She can't afford to look weak. Not at a time like this. It's not long after that when the phone call comes. They say there's been a credible threat from an extremist group. They've gotten hold somehow of pictures from inside the Republic of the Women. Pasted them all over the internet saying they were taken by a guy we all know has been dead for weeks. Terrible pictures. Probably photoshopped. Can't be real. They're not even making demands. Just rage and fear and threats of attacks unless... God, I don't know, Margot, unless something is done, I guess. The North is already threatening Bessapara with missiles over it. Margot says, We should do something.
The President says, I don't know. I feel like I should extend an olive branch.
And Margot says, Believe me, in a moment like this, you need to appear stronger than ever.
A strong leader. If that nation has been assisting in radicalizing our homegrown terrorists... We must send them a message. The world must know that the United States is willing to escalate. If you hit us with one jolt, we will hit you with two.
The President says,
I can't tell you how much I respect you, Margot, for the way you can carry on even with what's happened.
Margot says, My country comes first. We need strong leadership. There is a bonus in her contract if North Star deployments around the world top 50,000 women this year. The bonus would buy her a private island. The president says,
"You know there are rumors that they got hold of ex-Soviet chemical weapons."
And Margot thinks in her heart, "Burn it all down." There is a thought in those days. It is that 5,000 years is not a very long time. Something has been started now that must find its conclusion. When a person has taken a wrong turn, must she not retrace her steps? Is that not wise? After all, we've done it before. We can do it again. Different this time. Better this time. Dismantle the old house and begin again. When the historians talk of this moment, they talk about tensions and global instability. They posit the resurgence of old structures and the inflexibility of existing belief patterns. Power has her ways. She acts on people, and people act on her. When does power exist? Only in the moment it is exercised. To the woman with a skein, everything looks like a fight. Urban Doc says, "Do it." Margot says, "Do it." Awadi Atif says, "Do it." Mother Eve says, "Do it." And can you call back the lightning? Or does it return to your hand? Roxy sits with her father on the balcony, looking out at the ocean. It's nice to think that whatever happens, the sea will always be here.
"Well, Dad," says Roxy,
"you fucked that one up, didn't you?"
Bernie looks at his hands, palms and back. Roxy remembers when those hands were the most terrifying thing in the world to her.
"Yeah," he says. "Suppose so."
Roxy says with a smile in her voice,
"Learned your lesson, have you? You'll do it differently next time."
And they're both laughing. Bernie's hair tipped back to the sky and all his nicotine-stained teeth and filling showing.
"I should kill you, really," says Roxy.
"Yeah, you should, really. Can't afford to be soft, girl."
"That's what they keep telling me."
"Maybe I've learned my lesson. Took me long enough."
At the horizon, there is a flash across the skyline. Pink and brown, although it is nearly midnight.
"Bit of nice news," she says.
"I think I've met a bloke."
"Yeah?"
"Early days," she says. "With all this, it's a bit complicated. But yeah, maybe. I like him. He likes me."
She laughs her old throaty growl. "I got him out of a country full of mad women trying to kill him. And I own an underground bunker, so obviously he likes me."
"Grandchildren?" says Bernie, hopefully. Daryl and Terry are gone. Ricky's not going to be able to do anything in that department ever again.
Roxy shrugs. "Might do. Someone's got to survive these things, haven't they?"
A thought occurs to her. She smiles.
"Bet if I had a daughter, she'd be strong as fuck."
They have another drink before they go down.
Apocrypha, excluded from the Book of Eve. Discovered in a cave in Cappadocia, circa 1,500 years old. The shape of power is always the same. It is infinite. It is complex. It is forever branching. While it is alive like a tree, it is growing. While it contains itself, it is a multitude. Its directions are unpredictable. It obeys its own laws. No one can observe the acorn and extrapolate each vein in each leaf of the oak crown. The closer you look, the more various it becomes. However complex you think it is more complex than that. Like the rivers to the ocean, like the lightning strike, it is obscene and uncontained. A human being is made not by our own will, but by that same organic, inconceivable, unpredictable, uncontrollable process that drives the unfurling leaves in season, and the tiny twigs to bud, and the roots to spread in tangled complications. Even a stone is not the same as any other stone. There is no shape to anything except the shape it has. Every name we give ourselves is wrong. Our dreams are more true than our waking.
Dear Neil,
well, I must say, first of all, that I like your contortionist Mother Eve. I've seen some of those things done at the Underground Circus, and I've been very impressed. One of those women made my hand wave at everyone in the room, and even Selim could hardly believe afterwards that I hadn't done it myself. I suppose lots of things in the ancient scriptures can be accounted for that way. And I see what you've done with Tunde. I'm sure something like that has happened to thousands of men down the generations. Misattributions, anonymous work assumed to be female, men helping their wives or sisters or mothers with their work and getting no credit. And, yes, simple theft. I have some questions. The male soldiers at the start of the book. I know you're going to tell me that ancient excavations have found male warrior figures. But really, I suppose this is the crux of the matter for me. Are we sure those weren't just isolated civilizations? One or two amongst millions. We were taught in school about women making men fight for entertainment. I think a lot of your readers will still have that in mind when you have those scenes where men are soldiers in India or Arabia. Or those feisty men trying to provoke a war. Or gangs of men locking up women for sex. Some of us have had fantasies like that. Can I confess? Shall I confess that while thinking about this, I... No, I can't confess it. It's not just me, though, my dear. A whole battalion of men in army fatigues or police uniforms really does make most people think of some kind of sexual fetish, I'm afraid. I'm sure you learned the same thing as I did in school. The cataclysm happened when several different factions in the old world were unable to reach an accord, and their leaders, stupidly, each thought they could win a global war. I see you have that here. And you mentioned nuclear and chemical weapons, and of course the effect of electromagnetic battles on their data storage devices is understood. But does the history really support the idea that women didn't have skeins much before the cataclysm? I know about the occasional statues we find of women without skeins from before the cataclysm, but that could just be artistic license. Surely it makes more sense that it was women who provoked the war. I feel instinctively, and I hope you do too, that a world run by men would be more kind, more gentle, more loving, and naturally nurturing. Have you thought about the evolutionary psychology of it? Men have evolved to be strong worker homestead keepers, while women, with babies to protect from harm, have had to become aggressive and violent. The few partial patriarchies that have ever existed in human society have been very peaceful places. I know you're going to tell me that soft tissue doesn't preserve well, and we can't look for evidence of skeins in cadavers that are 5,000 years old. But shouldn't that give you pause too? Are there any problems that your interpretation solves that the standard model of world history leaves unsolved? I mean, it's a clever idea, I'll grant you, and maybe worth doing for that reason alone, just as a fun exercise. But I don't know if it advances your cause to make an assertion that can't be backed up or proved. You might tell me, that it's not the job of a work of history or fiction to advance a cause. Now I'm having an argument with myself. I'll wait for your reply. I just want to challenge your thinking here before the critics do. Much love, Naomi.
Dearest Naomi, thank you, first of all, for taking the time and trouble to read the manuscript. I was afraid it was practically incoherent. I'm afraid I've lost all sense of it. I have to say, I don't think much of evolutionary psychology, at least as it relates to gender. As to whether men are naturally more peaceful and nurturing than women, that'll be up to the reader to decide, I suppose. But consider this. Are patriarchies peaceful because men are peaceful? Or do more peaceful societies tend to allow men to rise to the top because they place less value on the capacity for violence? Just asking the question. Now, let's see. What else did you ask? Oh, the male warriors. I mean, I can send you images of hundreds of partial or full statues of male soldiers. They've been unearthed around the world. And we know how many movements have been devoted to completely obliterating all traces of the time before. I mean, just the ones we know about number in the thousands. We find so many smashed statues and carvings, so many obliterated marking stones. If they hadn't been destroyed, imagine how many male soldiers' statues there'd be. We can interpret them however we like, but it's actually pretty clear that around 5,000 years ago, there are a lot of male warriors. People don't believe it because it doesn't fit with what they already think. As to whether you find it believable that men could be soldiers, or what your sexual fantasies are about battalions of uniformed men, well, I can't be held responsible for that, Anne. I mean, I take your point, some people will just treat it as cheap porn. And that's always the tawdry inevitability if you write a rape scene. But surely serious people will see through that. Ah, yes, okay, you ask, does the history really support the idea women didn't have skeins much before the cataclysm? The answer is yes, it does. At least you have to ignore a huge raft of archaeological evidence to believe otherwise. This is what I've tried to communicate in my previous history books, but as you know, I don't think anyone wanted to hear it. I know you probably didn't mean it to come across as patronizing, but it's not just a fun idea to me. The way we think about our past informs what we think is possible today. If we keep on repeating the same old lines about the past when there's clear evidence that not all civilizations had the same ideas as us, we're denying that anything can change. Oh, God, I don't know. Now I've written that, I feel more uncertain than I did before. Were there particular things that you've read elsewhere that made you feel uncertain about this book? I might be able to work them in somewhere. Much love, and thanks again for reading it. I really do appreciate it. When yours is done, another masterpiece, I'm sure, I owe you a practical criticism essay on every chapter. Love, Neil.
Dear Neil, yes, of course, I didn't mean fun in the sense of trivial or stupid. I hope you know I'd never think that about your work. I have a lot of respect for you. I always have had. But all right, as you've asked. There's an obvious question for me. What you've written here contradicts so many of the history books we all read as children, and they're based on traditional accounts going back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. What is it that you think happened? Are you really suggesting that everyone lied on a monumental scale about the past? All love, Naomi.
Dear Naomi, thanks for getting back so quickly. So, in answer to your question, I don't know if I have to be suggesting that everyone lied. I mean, for one thing, of course, we don't have original manuscripts dating back more than 1,000 years. All the books we have from before the cataclysm have been recopied hundreds of times. That's a lot of occasions for errors to be introduced. And not just errors, all of the copyists would have had their own agendas. For more than 2,000 years, the only people recopying were nuns in convents. Now, I don't think it's at all a stretch to suggest that they picked works to copy that supported their viewpoint, and just let the rest moulder into flakes of parchment? I mean, why would they recopy works that said that men used to be stronger and women weaker? And that would be heresy, and they'd be damned for it. I mean, this is the trouble with history. You can't see what's not there. You can look at an empty space and see that something's missing, but there's no way to know what it was. I'm just drawing in the blank spaces. It's not an attack. Love, Neil.
Dearest Neil, I don't think it's an attack. It's hard for me to see women portrayed as they are at times in this book. We've talked about this often, how much what it means to be a woman is bound up with strength and not feeling fear or pain. I've been grateful for our honest conversations. I know you've sometimes found it difficult to form relationships with women, and I understand why. I'm so grateful that we've preserved a friendship out of what we had, though. It was so important to me that you listened when I said things that I'd never have been able to tell Salim or the children. The scene of the skein removal was very hard to read. Love, Naomi.
Dear Naomi, thank you for that. I know you're trying. You're one of the good ones. I really want this book to make something better, and I think we can be better than this. This thing isn't natural to us, you know? Some of the worst excesses against men were never, well, in my opinion anyway, perpetrated against women in the time before the cataclysm. 3 or 4,000 years ago, it was considered normal to cull 9 in 10 boy babies. Fuck, there are still places today where boy babies are routinely aborted or have their dicks curbed. This can't have happened to women in the time before the cataclysm. We talked about evolutionary psychology before. It would have made no evolutionary sense for cultures to abort female babies on a large scale or to fuck about with their reproductive organs. So it's not natural to us to live like this. It can't be. I can't believe it is. We can choose differently. The world is the way it is now because of 5,000 years of ingrained structures of power based on darker times when things were much more violent, and the only important thing was, could you and your kin jolt harder? But we don't have to act that way now. We can think and imagine ourselves differently once we understand what we've based our ideas on. Gender is a shell game. What is a man? Whatever a woman isn't, what is a woman? Whatever a man is not. Tap on it and it's hollow. Look under the shells. It's not there. Kisses, Neil.
Dearest Neil, have been pondering this all weekend. There's a lot to think about and discuss, and I think it's best if we meet to talk it over. I worry that I might write something that you'll interpret in the wrong way, and I don't want that. I know it's a sensitive topic for you. I'll ask my assistant if he'll sort out some dates for us to have lunch. This is not to say that I'm not behind the book. I really am. I want to make sure it reaches the widest possible audience. Best love, Naomi. P.S. I have one suggestion. You've explained to me how anything you do is framed by your gender, that the frame is as inescapable as it is nonsensical. Every book you write is assessed as part of men's literature. So what I'm suggesting is just a response to that, really, nothing more. But there's a long tradition of men who found a way out of that particular bind. You'd be in good company. Neil, I know this might be very distasteful to you, but have you considered publishing this book under a woman's name?
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Power, written by Naomi Alderman, read by Adjua Ando. The Power is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by Naomi Alderman. audio production copyright 2017 by Audible Limited. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.